1510 WMEX Quincy, Boston, and 101.1 FM W266 DQ Weymouth.
WMEX Quincy, Boston. Streaming at WMEXBoston.com. And on your smart speaker, just say play WMEX.
The greatest hits of all time are back. This is the all-new WMEX.
WMEX Boston.
They singing all night, drinking wine, spooty-ooty, drinking wine. Wine, spooty-ooty, drinking wine.
That's right, folks. It is time for Wine by Design with Len on 1510. The all-new WMEX. Your calls at 781-834-9639. Len Prasuti, your host. He has got over 30 years of wine consultation experience in the corporate world, and he's here to be your personal wine connoisseur. Here he is now, your host, Len Prasuti.
Well, thank you, Ben, and welcome everyone to Wine by Design. Just wanted to mention that in addition to calling in your questions to MEX at 781-834-9639, you can email me at lenwmex@gmail.com or lenwmex@gmail.com. And you can listen to past episodes at WMEXBoston.com or search Wine by Design on your favorite platform. Well, we have a full plate tonight, to put it mildly. A great listener question. Debbie wanted to know about aeration and with a little different twist. And we're going to get to that in just a little bit. Is, well, as since this is spring, we made our first foray into deep fried foods, which in the North Shore here means clams and calamari and oysters and all that good stuff. So we'll get to that in just a bit. But the first thing I wanted to talk about, since Sunday is Easter, are wines that would be great for your Easter table. Those of you that have been listening know that I've been working with Jerry on the Gennaro's wine list, and that's been a ton of fun for me. I tasted through six Barberas and actually went through last week, you know, why I chose the one I did and why I didn't choose the ones that I didn't. And well, the process is ongoing. I'm really excited about it. I found a 2019 Barolo that is drinking really well right now for Barolo. You know, they need a little air. Very, very approachable early on, and a few other wines that I'll talk about later. But three of the wines that look like they're going to make the list are really great selections for your Easter table. The first one is the Provence Rosé. You know, I probably had 15 or so different Provence Rosés over the past year or so, and I'm really critical when tasting them. I love them, and for the Easter table, we would do it as an aperitif. You know, just have a sip of something when everyone comes in, you kind of greet them. Certainly sparkling works really well there, but more and more people really are going to the Provence style rosés, and they're really dominating the wine world. They're wildly popular. But the one that we came up with is the Studio by Merivale. Now, it's interesting in that it's a joint venture between Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie and the Perrins that make Chateau de Bocastel. Now, I'm not normally into celebrities getting involved with wines or winemaking, but Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie did it the right way in partnering with the Perrins. I've had a chance to visit them over there a number of times, have hosted family members at dinners, as well as when the Boston Wine Expo was going on. They did a vertical of Chateau de Bocastel going all the way back to 1990. Just fantastic people, just as people, and phenomenal as winemakers. Everything from these very expensive Chateauneuf du Pape's they make to the simple little Vieille Ferme that is one of our everyday reds that we always have in our cellar. So they chose well when they partnered with the Perrins there, the incredible winemakers. It really is a traditional blend. The really good Provence rosés tend to be a blend of usually primarily Sanceau and Grenache, but with a little bit of Roll and Tiburon. It gives the wine a little bit more complexity and depth. And the studio was named after an actual music recording studio on their Provence estate. It's it's an active studio. Pink Floyd's recorded there, AC/DC. So there's a little bit of a story behind the name of the wine, but my God, the wine, talk about over-delivering. Right from the beginning, when you pour it into the glass, it has this gorgeous pale salmon color that it's funny. Some of them can be a little light. Some of them can be a little too dark, but that was just right from the beginning. Now, one of the things I'm looking for in a Provence rosé is that whetstone minerality. That's kind of a hallmark of it because we're talking dry rosés here, but a lot of interesting fruits going on. Got some almost kind of watermelon notes and some peach, kind of a dried peach. I think of peach pit because of the minerality. When you hear someone using the term peach pit, that's what they're aiming at. Is it kind of has the flavor of peaches, but it's got a real intense minerality to it. Little citrus peel, a lot of things going on there. But Provence rosés can be tricky because they tend either to be, and it's going to sound odd to say, but too easy to drink in that they're, they have no substance to them and they're a little bit flabby and they can kind of be fun. Or on the other hand, they can be so intense and powerful in flavor that they can have a bitterness to them and not be particularly fun to drink in that respect. This wine has all the fruit that I'm looking for, so that it's pleasant to drink, but there's this hint of this bitter orange, kind of like a bitter orange oil or something in there, but it just pulls everything into the right alignment. It's kind of like the alignment of the stars. And it just has a tremendous amount of complexity and depth, yet it's really fun to drink. So it has pretty much everything that you could want in a Provence rosé going for it. So that's why that one made the list. Now, the other two wines I'm going to mention are made from the same producer, Delacuiese. And those of you that listen to my food and wine matching rantings from time to time know that we are so into it that when it comes to desserts, we tend to have a particular favorite that works with every single dessert. Believe it or not, apple pie, the Durban Muscat Baume de Venise, and all that. But having said that, you can really cover just about any dessert imaginable using only two wines. And as I mentioned, both of these are from Delacuiese. It's a Moscato d'Asti. The Casarito is the proprietary name of it. Now, Moscato, most of you have had or at least heard about. It comes from the Piedmont region of France. And really refreshing. It has a pronounced frizzante. It is sparkling, but it's fairly low in alcohol. It's about 5% alcohol. And they make it in this method that's called kind of a bulk method. They often refer to it as Charmat. Martinotti is actually the proper way because he actually invented it, but somehow a Frenchman seem to take over the naming of it. But it's really, the Moscato is classic Moscato. It's got those peachy apricot notes, a really maybe even a little hint of anise and just a little bit of spice going on there. Extremely pleasant to drink. And that takes care of pretty much all the fruit desserts you can imagine out there. It would be great with carrot cake. It would work with a lemon meringue pie, for instance. So we have pretty much all those covered with that one. But the second one of Della Chiesa, which is from the same general area, is a Bracchetto da qui, the Valle della Rose. And that is essentially kind of a red Moscato. So it's got berry flavors going on there, like raspberries and maybe some strawberry. Really kind of nice floral hints there too, like rose and like a rose petal note and all that. But that takes care of pretty much all the chocolate desserts. It works extremely well with chocolate. And also tiramisu, which when you're talking Gennaro's, he makes, from what I understand, I haven't tried every tiramisu in the state, but one of the best in the state. And that's going to be absolutely amazing with that. So with just those two wines, you can cover about any dessert possibility out there. If you do have a specific question, I'd like to remind you, always contact me via email. We'll mention that again at the end of the day. But I did want to go into the whole ham, lamb, the entrees of Easter, because as you know, that can really make a huge difference. It can make your food taste better if you get something that's complementary. So with ham, taking ham first, the big factor that we have to deal with in matching wines with ham is the saltiness. As a matter of fact, hams tend to be so salty that it tends to affect the way you prepare it. Very often you'll use a sweet glaze because the sweet plays well off of the salt and kind of complements it. You know, so it could be a pineapple glaze, a brown sugar butter glaze, who knows, maybe cherries or something like that. So the secret is here, you want a wine without oak. As I've talked about before, the kind of exposed tannins in a Chardonnay really can become bitter and not pleasant when you're dealing with something a little sweet there. So that's out of the question. But what we're looking for is a white without oak with a little touch of sweetness. My absolute favorite go-to wine here is a Vouvray from the Loire Valley of France, made from Chenin Blanc. One of the reasons I love Vouvray so much is the fact that it has just this beautiful natural acidity that tends to be so high that to make the wine balanced, they have to allow for some residual sugar. And my favorite of all time is the Pichot. The family's been in the Loire Valley since the early 1700s and just makes a phenomenal wine that's right around that $20-$21 range. So that would be certainly my first choice. Some other great choices would be German wines, which are perfect in this situation. For me, I tend to go to the Mosel, a little bit better acidity. They always have some underlying minerality there too. But the beauty of German wine is some of the best examples out there are relatively inexpensive. One that I'd recommend very highly is the Adolf Müller, the Peace Porter Goldtropfen Cabinet. So the cabinets tend to have the least amount of sweetness because the grapes don't get quite as ripe. This one's well under $20 a bottle. So that would be a great possibility. If you did want to go with a red, Beaujolais is where we usually head. There's a really phenomenal one out there that's a little bit of an insider secret. A lot of us in the trade know about it, but it's the J.P. Brun Domaine de Terre Dorée, L'Ancienne Vieille Vigne. So it's pretty much just a fancy way of L'Ancienne, old vines, Vieille Vigne, old vines. Now, that one's right around that $20 range, too. But that has a lot of nice depth and complexity to it, along with that juicy fruit that's going to handle the saltiness of the ham. The other wine I came across this week that I'm really fond of was a Gewürztraminer, or we call them Gewürz. You know, technically, I tend to use the pronunciation from Alsace, where it's really well known. Anyway, we've been on a search for a great Gewürz from Alsace. And it seems like lately, just within the past few years, a lot of people are allowing so much residual sugar that the wine's definitely off dry. And it doesn't work in a lot of the food applications that we're looking to match it with. There's a restaurant on the North Shore that does an absolutely amazing Peking duck. And, you know, you have the hoisin sauce there along with the onions and the duck and all that. So they tend to either be too sweet for that or so high in alcohol that they just dominate. I mean, we're talking 15% here in some cases. But what we did find that it's our current favorite, and it's interesting in that this whole wine show goes two ways. I invite people to call in or email me with some of their favorite wines. Because as I mentioned, I'm looking for a Gewürz, and this one was from Washington State, the Chateau Saint-Michel from Columbia Valley. Classic Gewürz, lychee nuts, tons of spice. I'm talking about allspice, clove, cinnamon, a kind of a dried pear kind of quality. But it was beautifully vibrant and lively, which is what we're looking for in the Gewürz. Really nice a spiciness to the bright, vibrant fruit and a really long finish. And all that at 12% alcohol. So that is another one that is just this hair off dry that would work famously with the ham. Now, going to lamb, the two main ways to go here are rack. Now, if you're doing a rack of lamb, a lot of reds will work. Your favorite Bordeaux, that Cabernet Sauvignon from Napa that you've been holding on to, waiting for a special occasion to open. But the other thing you might look at, a rack of lamb, which is probably going to sound a bit odd, is a big, buttery California Chardonnay. It actually works amazingly well with meat. I talked about it working with steak before, but I've actually had situations with lamb chops where it was just brilliant with it. But the other preparation that people tend to go a little bit to are the leg of lamb rubbed with rosemary, studded with garlic, that kind of thing. The Rhone wines are my go-to there. Even something as simple as a plain Cote de Rhone, which can be a phenomenal value, can work really well in that situation. But our absolute favorites are the wines of the Northern Rhone, which are, instead of being that blend of the Southern Rhone with Grenache in it, you're talking primarily Syrah, if not exclusively. The wine that I would recommend that's an amazing value, I've talked about on the show before, the Francois Villard. It's the Appel de Sirene Syrah, and that comes in at about $18 a bottle. And again, it gives you all that pepper and fruit and all that that would accompany the lamb amazingly well. The same producer also does a cote roti, in actual honest, the God cote roti. Now, that's kind of one of these pulling out all the stop wines. It's in the $60, $70 range. But at that price, his, believe it or not, is phenomenal, called La Galette Blanc. And many of the great cote rotis go well into the $100, $200 range. The wine that we have picked, which we are going to do rack, but we are doing a wine from the Northern Rhone. It's a Gigal Saint-Joseph, but it's a very special bottling that they do. It's Ludi de Saint-Joseph, and it comes from these old vines that were the original old vines that is the reason this region is called Saint-Joseph. So not inexpensive, around that $75 range, but we have the 2015 standing up in our cellar, ready to be decanted. We've had it before. Phenomenal wine, just a tremendous amount, 95 rating from the Wine Spectator. Incredibly complex, length off the charts, kind of this warm fig, blackberry, black currant, but even some mocha hints from the really ripe fruit and this weird kind of almost graphite minerality there that is just spectacular. So I'll report on that one next week and let you know how that goes. Now, on to a listener question. One of our regular listeners, Debbie, had a great question about how much air to give a red wine. But what made the question so interesting to me is she actually asked about, what about white wines and what about sparkling? Well, my answer to her was, I give pretty much every red we drink at least an hour's air. I can't think of any reds that are really hurt by that, and almost all of them are improved. With the older ones, like the one we mentioned to you that we're going to be opening for Easter, the time varies. That one, we're going to open at least 3 hours in advance. I did some research with some friends and online, and that seems to be the consensus. We've had a bottle before, but not for a long time. Did want to mention to you, feel free to contact me if you have a specific wine that you've been wondering about how much air to give the wine before you drink it. As you know, I'm a huge fan of aeration because it's something that doesn't really cost you any more money, but can really increase the pleasure factor of that wine dramatically. On to the whites. People don't usually think of decanting a white wine or giving a white wine air. You might notice that sometimes, even a simple Pinot Grigio, after you've been drinking it for about 10 or 15 minutes, it tends to taste a little bit better. Most of that is due to the temperature change, because the temperature of the wine comes up, and as it comes up, everyone, myself included, you always tend to start with the white wines a little bit too cool. So then a lot more flavor tends to come out for that reason, and a little bit of it could be aeration. But the wines that are meant to be aged, such as white Burgundy, really can benefit dramatically from being thrown into a decanter. I know that might sound odd, but especially like a Chassagne Montrachet, a Meursault, or something like that, especially if it's Premier Cru, and especially if you're hitting it 3 or 4 years after bottling, because most of those are meant to be drunk around that 6, 8 year range. That's when they tend to kind of have the most complexity that they're going to have and hold from that. Usually an hour will do it to let that white wine open up. But again, feel free to reach out if you have any questions about it. The thing that most people don't realize is that you can decant sparkling wine. And in many restaurants, they do, the great, great restaurants out there with paid sommeliers that in many cases are at the top of their craft, will often decant a wine like some tête de cuvée that was really meant to be aged a long time. One of the ones that occurs to me, and because I had an experience with it that where it really showed incredibly well, was Cristal. Now, what they would do typically, because you're at the restaurant and you don't have the time to just pop the cork and let the bottle sit there for a while, they'll actually pour it into a decanter very gently down the side of the decanter. Got to make sure that the decanter's chilled because you don't want the champagne to go to too low a temperature. But if you do that, it can dramatically change the flavor of the wine. Some vintages of Cristal are really kind of backward and need a lot of air. And lately, some of them are a little bit more forward. But that really came home to me when I was doing a champagne seminar at the corporate headquarters where I was the wine educator. And I was having trouble with my PowerPoint presentation. I couldn't get it to work. So anyway, I called up to IT and a very nice young lady came down and was just so helpful. And I was so grateful because I thought, oh my God, I spent all this time on the PowerPoint and I'm not going to be able to use it. I asked her if she had ever had Cristal champagne before. And she said, no. So I opened the bottle and gave her a taste. Now, this is about 3 hours before we got to that bottle in the tasting. I chilled it down a little bit more to make sure the temperature was right. And it just so happened that in that time frame, right around the time when this champagne seminar was going on, I'd had the opportunity to taste Cristal. It was like 4 or 5 times. It was a new vintage. People were showing it in these tastings. That's the nice thing about being in the trade. You get to taste through tons and tons of wine, and it just wasn't showing well. The wine that night blew everyone, myself included, away because it had a chance to breathe to the point where it softened. And when it was served without that aeration, it was really tight and wasn't giving very much of what it had to give. So the reason they do that with a decanter, obviously, in the restaurant is unless you're doing a 3-hour meal at the French Laundry or something of that sort, you need to get to that wine pretty quickly. About 20 minutes, believe it or not, in the decanter will do the job. But again, if you're going to try this at home, make sure you chill the decanter. Now, I wanted to talk just a little bit about wines with fried foods, mainly fried clams. And we're big fans of all fried foods. The North Shore has some of the best restaurants for that ever. I mean, I think everyone knows about Woodman's. That's where they said that fried clams were invented. Everyone has an opinion on who's the best. There's the Clam Box that's really amazing and has always been a personal favorite of the Prosciutto family. But we decided to try Farnham's, and we did smalls of pretty much everything. So we did fried oysters, we did fried calamari, and fried clams, and opened 3 different bottles that were some of our favorites that we really felt like, okay, these are tried and true. This is really going to show this food off to the best effect. But we had a little bit of a surprise. I'm going to name the 3 first. There was a Muscadet 2022, a sparkling Mums Napa Blanc de Blanc, and a Sauvignon Blanc from the Loire Valley. So the big surprise for us was this Muscadet. Muscadet and oysters match made in heaven. We always tried the fried oysters first. And we always have a go-to Muscadet. It's the Chateau La Régatière Vieille Vigne, really old vines there, up to 60 years of age. We've been drinking this wine for, it has to be like 20 years. One of the main reasons we started with it, because it is a very good wine, but it was one of the first Muscadets out there to go to the Stelvin closure or the screw cap, which I've talked about before, really keeps the wine fresh and clean. But back then, it seemed like every other bottle of Muscadet we had was corked. The worst problem with badly corked bottles we've had was with Muscadets and simple Chiantis, because they were using very very cheap corks that often had that TCA in it. But this wine was totally uncharacteristic of a Muscadet. I'm going to have to leave it there. It's going to be a little bit of a cliffhanger, but Suffice it to say that it wasn't the match that we planned it to be, and we actually bought a case of it because it was so reliable in the past. But that's about it for this week. You've been listening to Wine by Design with Len on 1510. Thanks for listening, and until next week, all the best in wine and life.